Good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming. I'm a little under the weather, so my voice may be a little whatever. I will do my best. So this is Memorial Day weekend. Many of us are involved in various kinds of social activities over this weekend. It's a time for taking a trip, having a vacation. Probably many of our usual people aren't here today because of that. But as I was reflecting about it, and especially seeing that news about the latest violence in our own country, in the same way, I think that as individuals, that when we find ourselves in aversive relationships where there is anger, hurt, resentment, conflict, and we know that in those times we always perceive our position, whatever it is, as right, and we usually perceive the other person's position as wrong. We see ourselves as good in the moment and them as bad. And even if there are people that we love or care about or in very positive ways, we know in that moment of anger, hurt, resentment, life becomes very one-dimensional. And we only see them like a cartoon character that only has the characteristics of badness, in whatever form we are perceiving. And the bigger picture of who and what this person is, sadly, is very quickly forgotten in those moments. And each of us know that in those moments, when there is anger, when there is conflict, the potential for doing harm is great. Often in just a few words, we can hurt somebody. And obviously, in situations that are more than a few words and go on for hours or days, the harm to the relationship can be great. And we know that when there is that kind of conflict and their kind of anger, resentment, sense of righteousness, depending on our own causes and conditions, the seeds of acting out and hurting are very close. For many of us, that is only a hurting and an aggression that is verbal. But sometimes behind that verbalness, there is a kind of anger and a wanting to hurt. Because we hurt, we want to hurt the other. We want to stop the other from doing what they're doing. And so behind, if those of us, because of our own causes and conditions, are able to not go beyond words, that kind of aggression that can lead to violence and physical harm is not that far away, is it? If we are honest with ourselves. And many people, break things, throw things, do other kinds of things like that. But again, we know that many people in that stage do violence. Violence, it's not, the violence that comes out when there are these shootings and mass killings and everything that seem so irrational and so... But these are just the explosions. It's sort of like, the volcano that we see when the lava erupts. But it is the violence is much deeper, and the explosion comes. But the force that has been building up in the volcano has been there a long time. The seeds are there. And so when we understand those kinds of seeds within ourselves and the potential we all have, on Memorial Day is to memorialize what? Soldiers. People who have died in the service of their country. And it's often a time for those who don't just see it as a holiday, it is a time for remembering the soldiers and their sacrifice. But because war and violence have been so present in the human experience for so long, in the same way, if we find that we erupt from time to time in anger, and that we do harm when we do that, and if we are people on some kind of spiritual path or path of transformation, and we want to look more deeply into the seeds and the sources of our own anger, because we know that that is destructive of relationship and is destructive of my own aspiration to be a compassionate, loving, caring, patient, understanding human being, I need to stop and look more deeply to what are the seeds, what are the causes within my own mind that nurtures and allows these types of eruptions to occur. Again, these eruptions are always, the potential is always there. Our angers, our resentments, our hurts may be like hot coals. You know, a hot coal, if they're left alone for a while, they'll cover over with ash. You won't see the redness, will you? So you'll think, if you've ever touched anything like that, you know, it could be a rude awakening to find out, they're still very active. Just the fact that we are all sitting here, and perhaps none of us today in this moment are angry or have those kinds of feelings within us, yet many of us, the coals are there. In the same way in our society, collectively, those coals are there. And they're just waiting for the right kind of wind to be stirred up and fired up, and then the flame goes. So we know in our own country on this Memorial Day, we have been in wars fairly continually, haven't we? And even though we have participated in wars to end all wars, even though we always have participated in wars that we perceive as just, and even though there has been hope that this is the last one, they still continue, and even they seem to accelerate, don't they? And even though we become more sophisticated in our technology and many of our outward appearances in this life, whether it is war or whether it is the violence that we see in these eruptions in schools and young people and all people, we know that the seeds of violence are epidemic in our culture, aren't they? And again, I'm not a sociologist. I'm not going to go into it on that level. But we know in our own tradition, the Buddhist tradition, we know that nonviolence, the not doing of harm, is central teaching of the Buddha in terms of his social teaching, right? His teachings about how human beings are to conduct themselves with each other. Because we do live in relationship with each other. The fundamental principle is do no harm. If you cannot do no harm, at least do the least harm. Because again, since the Buddhist teaching is solely present in our world to alleviate suffering, what is a greater suffering than the suffering that is created by war and violence? I mean, we see it in small things, and we see it in where? Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Congo. I mean, that's just to begin, right? The list. It is endless. The suffering that war creates, that violence creates. So again, in the same way that it behooves us as individuals to look deeply into the seeds of our own and how to transform those seeds of anger and resentment and violence, that is the basis for how to do it societally. It is the same process. There's all kinds of reasons, justifications for war, but that's all theoretical. Right. We know that the people who make war, who make the decisions to send soldiers to war, are not the ones who fight it, are they? They are far away. They are safe. And it is that lack of presence to the suffering that war creates, that violence creates, that often allows it to continue. I am sure that if President Obama's wife and children had been accidentally killed by a drone strike, he would look very differently at collateral damage. So it is important that we stop. And we, even though the world is divided up into friends and enemies, and again, we need to look deeply into that. Many of us lost family and relatives in World War II, fighting who? The Germans and the Japanese, who are now what? Our friends, or perhaps helping us kill other people who were also at one point our friends, our allies, who are now our enemies. There's a poem I wanted to read by Thich Nhat Hanh. Everybody, I believe, knows Thich Nhat Hanh. And his teachings and his ideas about engaged Buddhism were forged in war, right? He came of age when he was young in Vietnam, when his country was involved with an anti-colonial kind of war with the French, and then then that was followed by the American War in Vietnam. And the Buddhist community was very involved in trying to stop the violence. So this is a poem of his. You know, he was beside a Zen master and an advocate for peace. He's also one of modern Vietnam's great poets. His poems are widespread, known throughout Vietnam, and many of them actually have been turned into songs that the people sing. So this poem is called Recommendation. Promise me this day, while the sun is just overhead, even as they strike you down with a mountain of hate and violence, remember, brother, man is not our enemy. It's a great line of his. Man is not our enemy. Just your pity, just your hate, invincible, limitless. Hatred will never let you face the beast in man. And one day, when you face this beast alone, your courage intact, your eyes kind, out of your smile will bloom a flower, and those who love you will behold you across 10,000 worlds of dying and birth. Alone again, I'll go on, with bent head, but knowing the immortality of love. And on the long, rough road, both sun and moon will shine, lighting my way. Very beautiful. Remember, brother and sister, man is not our enemy. That is a label we give to another human being, isn't it? And if we take off that label, what do we see? If we take off the label of friend or enemy, if we take off the label of Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, Muslim, all the sectarian, all the religious, all the political, if we take off those labels, what do we find? A human being, like every other human being, who wants what? Who wants to be happy? Right? Who wants good things for their children, for their family, for their loved ones? Right? Who wants to feel safe? I mean, what? There's nothing unclear when we pull away the labels and understand that these names that we give to these human beings are just allow us to turn away from them, allow us to pursue activities with these human beings that are harmful. So we have to be careful of labels. And Buddhist meditation practice allows us to pull the labels off. And these labels, we label at work, we label at home, we label our loved ones. We're always labeling people, right? They say one thing, and they're our enemy. 20 minutes later, they say another thing, and we think, well, they're pretty good. I really like them, something happens and, can you see this mind always bifurcating around? And the truth is, it's still the same human being, isn't it? When we do not experience our fellow human beings as connected to us, when there is disconnection, when there is there can be disinterest and there can be the potential for harm or indifference, but when we acknowledge at some level our human connection, our human family, everything would change, right? If it was our cousins, our aunts and uncles, our brothers and sisters under the bombs, we would be very strongly motivated to do something, wouldn't we? But when we just perceive that these are just we don't even think about it often, do we? We allow things to happen. Even as we pass people who are homeless or people who are suffering in some way, if we all of a sudden look at them and go, oh, that's my friend from high school, that's my cousin, we wouldn't pass them by, would we? We would want to help them. We would want to find out how they got into that condition. So we have to realize that a man is not our enemy. And the beast is in us. The beast of violence, the beast of anger, the beast of hurt, the beast of resentment. It's all in me. And we have to face this. I love it when he says, we have to face this beast alone, our courage intact. Everyone here knows the beast. It may be a different kind of beast for each of us. Right? But we know there is that part of ourselves that, left to its own device, does not seek the good of ourselves and others. It is lost in its own self-absorption, self-concern. It's lost in its own needs and wants. It's lost in its own stuff, its own issues. And left to its own capacity for running about amok, we at some point, if we want to truly awaken and lead an awakened altruistic life, we have to acknowledge there is this beast inside of us, and we have to be willing to face it. Where do we face it? We face it on the cushion. We face it in the quiet and stillness of our own mind. Courage intact, our eyes kind, right? This beast, even though there's an ugliness to it, because its emotions and its thoughts are not the highest and the finest, it is a wounded beast, isn't it? And we don't have to hate it. We don't have to be embarrassed by it. We can look at it with kindness, because it suffers. Your eyes kind, out of your smile will bloom a flower. Oh, you know, in the pictures of the Buddha prior to his enlightenment, in the representations, we see that the forces of delusion are shooting these arrows at him. All right, there are all these arrows coming in from all these various sides, and there are all these kind of creatures shooting them at him. And then it's always interesting because usually around the Buddha there's a nimbus, kind of an aura. And what happens, what you see is when these arrows get inside his kind of aura, they become flowers. They have no capacity to harm him. And not only do they have no capacity to harm them, he can transform them. How? Through his understanding and through his compassion. And so this beast within us, this beast within our society, these beasts within our fellow human beings can be dealt with if we have the courage. But again, our tools are not more judgment, more violence, more anger, more hatred. Our tools are understanding, love, compassion. And so that is why this is the capacity is always there. You know, I wanted to, in thinking about Memorial Day, and thinking about the path, I always come back to the mindfulness trainings of the Order of Interbeing. And those who've been around a while are aware of this. This is this Buddhist order of lay people, monks and nuns that Thich Nhat Hanh founded in Vietnam in the 60s, in the midst of war. And he took the traditional formulations of Buddhist morality and presented them for what was going on right then and there. And I think they are so relevant because they are personal. They point directly to how we, each of us, can in our life really, you know, nonviolence is not an ideology, it's not a philosophy, it is a way of life. And we have to understand that nonviolence is something that we manifest in all the actions of our life, in all our relationships, in all the ways we relate to each other, to the environment, even to the things that we interact with, even inanimate things. Because we can be harmful and violent even with inanimate things. His first mindfulness training, Aware of the suffering created by fanaticism and intolerance, we determine not to be idolatrous about or bound to any doctrine, theory, ideology, even Buddhist ones. How wonderful, right? Because most ideologies, most religions do not say that, do they? Right? But here it says, even Buddhist ones. Buddhist teachings are guiding means to help us learn to look deeply and develop our understanding and compassion. They are not doctrines to fight, kill, or die for. I mean, right then and there, we would eliminate what? Most of the wars that are being fought these days. Because most of the wars being fought these days are less around, you know, in the old days they used to love to fight over what? Territory, you know, grabbing other people's territory, other people's resources. But these days, and this is why I think Thich Nhat Hanh put this first, because he saw in his own country people were killing each other over ideology, over ideas. How do you kill an idea? You think you're killing an idea by killing the person who has the idea. But that's crazy. Right? Because ideas are things that keep going. That anybody could pick up at any time. So the transformation has to go on with the human beings. But we think, like Thich Nhat Hanh says, thinking we're killing the ideology, we kill another human being. And yet, know how many human beings we kill. Those wrong ideas continue, don't they? Buddhist teachings are guiding means to help us learn to look deeply and develop our understanding, compassion. They're not doctrines to fight, kill, or die for. So we are determined not to be idolatrous or bound to any doctrine, theory, or ideology. Here he says even Buddhist ones, and I would just add, even our own. there's certainly nothing wrong with having ideas, especially ideas that you see are ennobling or beneficial, but they are not worth causing harm about. Aware of the suffering, this is the second one, created by attachment to views and wrong perceptions, we are determined to avoid being narrow-minded and bound to present views. I mean, what if this was the ideology of the State Department? You know, the ideology of our politicians. You know, there's a wonderful humility in all this, right? It is possible, you know, just to hold that, you know, is it possible that my views and my perceptions could possibly be wrong? Right? I mean, for many people, that is unthinkable. And again, with each of us, traditionally, as individuals, our capacity to do harm is somewhat limited. But when you have governments and people who have control of vast resources of weaponry and army and other kinds of things, soldiers, that is quite dangerous. Capacity of doing harm, you know, self-reflection. Am I sure? You know, Buddhism, we always ask that question, you know, is it true? We challenge all our perceptions, all our thoughts. Is it true? Is it true that this is the way things are unfolding? Is it true that this person is really that or did this? This is what this person's really thinking or feeling or what, you know? Is it true? And usually when we ask, is it true, it stops us in our tracks, doesn't it? But we are usually not willing to ask that. We are too swept away by our emotions. We are too caught up in our own self-righteousness to even acknowledge I might be misperceiving this. We shall learn and practice non-attachment from views in order to be open to others' insights and experiences. We are aware that the knowledge we presently possess is not changeless absolute truth. Truth is found in life. Again, one of these clarion calls, right? Truth is found in life. What is life? This is life. Right? So the truth of our ideas, the truth of our perceptions, the truth of what's true can only be found if we are willing to be present to life. Right? You know, have all the killing and destruction we have unleashed in Afghanistan and Iraq, have they produced peace in these societies? Have they produced well-being in the society? Has the violence been worth it? Has the destruction been worth it? How would we know? By reading the newspapers? By reading the reports of the government? No. We would know by what? By going there, wouldn't we? Or talking to somebody who's been there and actually seen what's really going on. Because truth is found in life. And we are ready to observe it throughout our lives. I wonder what a very open and creative stance for each of us to take in our lives. Third one, aware of the suffering brought about when we impose our views on others. Right? Again, if you look at the violence in the world, from biggest to smallest, it's because people are trying to impose their views on others, convert others, make people change their view from one to another. We impose it. And again, in this he says, we're determined to avoid being narrow-minded, bound to present view. We're committed to being non-attached from views, open others' insights, aware that the knowledge we presently possess, and not to force our views even on our children by such use as authority, threat, money, propaganda, indoctrination. We will respect the right of others to be different, and to choose what to believe and how to decide. We will, however, help others renounce fanaticism and narrowness through compassionate dialogue. What a brilliant thought. Other people have a right to their own views. Other people have a right to their own way of living. Other people have a right to their own culture. Right? And we have no right to impose it, to force anyone to be different than they are. And yet, it's not as if we are, again, indifferent to potential for negative things occurring in life. So what's our answer? Compassionate dialogue. Again, what a radical thought. Right? That when somebody does something we don't like, both as an individual, another human being, our friends, our partners, our work colleagues, or another country, or a group, or a radical whatever group that has attacked us, rather than just responding from anger and hurt and resentment and wanting to hurt back, right? Compassionate dialogue, right? Who are you? Who are you? And tell me about your suffering. You know, it's interesting with all these, even at the small level, all this epidemic violence in our own country, you know, with these kind of mass shootings and other things. When you read about their lives, including the young man yesterday, right, out in California, What do you find? Do you find a happy human being? No. You find a suffering human being. And you don't just find a suffering human being, a suffering teenager, you find a greatly suffering teenager. Right? Alone, angry, hurt, isolated, lost in all kinds of their own misperceptions about life and the cause of their suffering, right? We will never end this epidemic by more guards in the school, will we? By more guns. It's crazy, isn't it? Because the problem is in the suffering of human beings. And until we are willing to look deeply into what's causing the suffering, how do you find out what's causing the suffering? Well, the simplest level, dialogue, right? Right? You know, when we are angry with somebody, when we are resentful of somebody, when we're hurt by somebody and we're in our self-righteous place, right? How often are we willing to engage in compassionate dialogue with it? Tell me why you did what you did. Tell me what's going on inside you. I want to know. Why do I want to know? You know, as long as we go case by case, situation by situation, nothing will change, right? Like war will always continue. Why? Because every war is justified, isn't it? Right? People that go off and kill other people for a lark. Right? So there's always strong justification for the soldiers and for the civilians who support them and send their children off. And of course, what we forget is on the other side, they're doing the same thing. With the same justification, with the same high ideals. So it will never stop on a case by case. In the same way, the relationship with this other person will never get better if we go case by case. It's only when we step back and adopt a very different modus operandi. Compassionate dialogue. Let's talk. I want to know you. I want to know why you suffer. No, I want to know why you're angry at me. I want to know why you're acting so hateful to me. Maybe there's, you know, we never think. Maybe there's a reason. Could it be? The reason could be the stuff I've done. Well, that's a radical thought. Or it could be there are things within the other person that cause them to react the way they do, right? And, you know, lots of combinations of that. We will only discover that if we what? Engage in compassionate dialogue. Right? Dialogue is what? This is also a radical concept for many of us. We think communication is about what? Getting my point across. Right, isn't that? Right? Isn't that what communication is a point? Getting my point across, making sure that I'm understood. Right? Oh, I'm supposed to understand the other person's point of view. I never thought of that. Oh, that's what a dialogue is about, too. Compassionate means what? That the dialogue, the back and forth, is about alleviating suffering. Because whenever we are in conflict, there is suffering present. Has anybody been in a conflict where there's just been a lot of joy and happiness? Good feeling, warmth, you know, we laugh, it's so ridiculous. No, there is suffering present in conflict. Uh-huh. Aware that looking deeply at the nature of suffering can help us develop compassion and find ways out of suffering. We determine not to avoid or close our eyes before suffering. We're committed to finding ways to be with those who suffer, so we can understand their situation deeply and help them transform their suffering into compassion, peace, and joy. Again, this is just an extension. When that's in our own little life, this is where we learn how to do it. Right? When we look around in our own little world. And that could be the world within our personal relations, families, friends, communities, work. Are we willing to come out of our delusive bubble and really acknowledge that there's suffering around us? That people are not happy. People are not at peace. People are stressed. To me, stress is suffering. Many people, stress is normal. People are stressed, they're suffering. People are anxious, pressured, they're suffering. People are resentful, they're suffering. Are we willing to be present and name it for what it is? And again, are we willing to be present to those situations and those people to find ways, you know, is there another way that we can be doing this? Again, oftentimes we think we have to have the answer, don't we? But I don't think we have to have the answer. None of this you've heard so far says that we have to have the answer, does it? Right? It's often a matter of a willingness to not have the answer, but to be present to another human being or a group of human beings and say, first, can we acknowledge that what's going on here is suffering? There's not happiness here, you know? And can we then find ways together, creative ways, to find our ways to meaning and happiness. You know what I'm saying? And that's a wonderful journey, isn't it? That's a creative journey. And we can do that in our own personal life, and we could do that societally. Right? I mean, it just struck me, I mean, what if we had a core of compassionate interviewers, dialoguers, right? Who we sent in before we sent the troops in. Right? Right? Not intelligence gatherers. Oxymoron there. You know, but people who go and, you know, what's really going on there? What are people really thinking or feeling? What do people really want? Can we find common ground? Right? This is all the stuff that we know in personal relations works. You know, it'll work equally on national and international if we're willing. The fifth is aware that true happiness is rooted in peace, solidity, freedom, compassion, not in wealth or fame. We're determined not to take the aim of our life, fame, profit, wealth, sensual pleasure, nor to accumulate wealth while millions are hungry and dying. Committed to living simply and sharing our time, energy, and resources with those in need. The sixth, aware that anger blocks communication and suffering. We're determined to take care of the energy of anger when it arises and to transform and recognize the seeds of anger that lie deep in our consciousness. When anger comes up, we're determined not to do or say anything but to practice mindful breathing, walking, and acknowledge, embrace, and look deeply into our anger. We will learn to look with the eyes of compassion at those we think are the cause of our anger. So again, you can see these all are kind of variations on a deeper theme, and they all kind of weave a seamlessness. Again, on this Memorial Day, we know the great motivator of war and violence is what? Anger. Anger at the enemy. Are we willing to turn it around and look into that anger and see its seeds and acknowledge of all the human emotions, it is without the most dangerous. There is a reason in the Buddhist categorization of afflictive emotions that anger is given its own precept. It is because anger has such a potential for harm, both personally, interpersonally, and societally. So it is the afflictive emotion that we must be most attentive to, most careful with, most skillful with, for obvious reasons. And then he has a nice one on being happy in the present moment and all that, but we'll skip that because we know that. That is why we're here. Happy people, contented people, people who know how to live deeply in the present moment, who are free of worries and concern, they cannot be manipulated so easily, can they? But people who have strong seeds of fear and anger and hurt and resentment, it's easy to whip them up, isn't it? It's easy to get them to jump on the bandwagon, because those seeds that are there are already disturbing the individual. And how wonderful to take those seeds and put that energy on someone. Again, it justifies it. And it's energizing in the short run. Unfortunately, it doesn't ever work. There is no way, as the Buddha said, violence and hatred and anger can only be stopped by love, by understanding, by compassion. Violence can never end violence. It just passes it on. It will come out in another form. And we know that. Why is that? Because here we are, you know, thousands of years later. Lots of violence to end violence. Lots of war to end war. Lots of war and violence to bring peace. And yet, it's just epidemic. It is our first response, isn't it? And we wonder why individuals, when they see their country acting that way, why individuals also don't begin to act that way. Aware that the lack of communication always brings separation and suffering. Again, compassionate listening, loving speech. Yeah, lots of good things about communication. Aware that the essence of a Sangha or a spiritual community is the practice of understanding and compassion. Well, that's interesting. For those of you who think that the aim of a spiritual community like our community is to produce first-rate meditators, this is a reminder. This is not what we're here for. The aim of an essence of a Sangha, of a community, is the practice of understanding and compassion. Oh, that's what we're here for. And our meditation, our mindfulness, is a means to that. Again, this is very important. We often get into the spiritual life, the meditative life, again, in a very technology way, right? This is a new kind of technology that I'm going to perfect. I'm going to get good at. And then always our relationship with our meditation is pass, fail, good, bad, right? That's a judgment of our spiritual life, of our practice. But this is not what's being said here, is it? The aim and essence of our life is the practice of understanding and compassion. That's what we should be concerned with. You know, am I becoming more understanding, more patient, more accepting, more loving, more compassionate, more caring, more selfless, right? Less selfish? That's the criteria that we should be judging our practice on, not on our meditative concentration. Not to say again that these things aren't part of the process of training, retraining our mind, but that they are not what this is about, is it? Right? I mean, how many of us would go to a concert to hear a great musician present how they do scales? Hmm? 2 hours of listening to somebody do scales perfectly. We wouldn't be, you know, no, we want to hear beautiful music, don't we? Yeah. Yeah, we want our community, we want our personal life to be a flowering of beautiful things, right? Not just or perfection of our meditative concentration. Yeah. And then I'll end with the 12th. Aware that much suffering is caused by war and conflict, we are determined to cultivate nonviolence, understanding, and compassion in our daily lives, to promote peace education, mindful mediation, reconciliation within families, communities, nations, the world. We are determined not to kill and not to let others kill. We will diligently practice deep looking with our Sangha, our spiritual community, to discover better ways to protect life and prevent war. So again, I think on Memorial Day, this really is our injunction, isn't it? At the same time, to remember those people who have died in war is worthy. But if we don't look more deeply, like we've tried to do today, we are missing the real opportunity. If we don't acknowledge that even with their sacrifice of their life, that which was promised, peace, you know, a world without violence, the capacity of human beings to live at peace with one another, has not been accomplished. Right? And if we don't look deeply to understand there are reasons, like we've been doing today, we will just keep repeating it over and over. So we need to look deeply to discover better ways to protect life and prevent war. So that is our injunction. And again, even though we may not be able to accomplish that within our society today, we can certainly make the commitment in our personal life to be a nonviolent person. To be a nonviolent person means a person who does the least harm. The least harm in our relationships, the least harm in our environment, our consumerism, et cetera. We need to look deeply how our actions of body, speech, and mind may be causing harm to other human beings, to the planet, to animals, et cetera. And we can all do that. We all have that capacity. Recently, there were two members of our community, two really wonderful members of our community, who were locked in a conflict. Different views. And in that conflict, became angry at each other and all the things we talked about. And when I worked with them in a beginning a new ceremony, I said to them, if the two of you cannot live in peace with one another, there is no hope for the world. And I meant that. There is absolutely no hope for the world if two intelligent people who have altruistic intentions, who have the Dharma and the teachings of the Dharma, cannot put them into practice and live in harmony with one another, the world will never change. And it's your fault. It's your fault. And that's important, that we feel that sense of responsibility. Right? Because I would imagine everybody in here, would like a peaceful world, right? Would like human beings to live at peace and harmony with one another. I would like a world where we all take care of one another, watch out for one another, right? Again, if that's true, then we have to become that kind of person who can do that. If we don't do that, if we just pay lip service, how can we expect people who don't have these tools and these aspirations, right, to do it? It is foolhardy. So again, at the end of the day, it is important that we realize why is the world the way it is? Because of me. Because of me. And when I can really transform all the seeds of suffering within myself, and I can manifest in my life the human being's capacity to be a loving, understanding, kind, peaceful human being, and live that way in the world, then I have something to offer the world. But if I don't do it, all I have is words to offer the world. Is that clear? And that is why there have been many, 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 many people for a long time who've had wonderful ideas about a peaceful world and why we still don't have that. Because it is a peaceful world can only be created by peaceful people who need to become those peaceful people, all of us in this room. Right? So maybe today there are 40 and 50 and 30 on the stream, that's what? 80. You know, if each of us makes a commitment to become that person, and we're all in relationship, right? We all have friends, family, work, colleagues, right? Involved in various kinds of communities, right? So all of us, right? You know, 80 people, maybe we interact with 10, right? Now we got 800 cooking. Right? Can you see? We all have the capacity of making a difference in this world. So good. So we will end. Thank